So good evening. Thank you for joining us for the March 2nd, council briefing. This is a special briefing. We have a couple items to go over with you this evening. The first thing that we want to do is just take a couple of minutes, since we have our attorney, Cliff Shepherd, with us, who had helped us with our charter amendments last time around. At our last briefing, the council indicated there were two charter amendments that you would like to put forward in the November election. One of them was to address the issue, the failed item of gender neutrality for the mayor. And the other item was to revisit the appointment of a vacated seat for council. And I think there were a lot of questions that you all had with regards to the language of both of those items. So I thought it'd be good if you had Cliff here for the first 5, 10, 15 minutes to be able to discuss with him your thoughts, maybe ask some questions about what he's seen in terms of relevant charter language so that he can start the drafting process and get that to you to start reviewing as soon as possible. I would also like to point out that the clerk's office was contacted today by the supervisor of elections. They have revised their due date for us to get them ballot initiatives for this November's election. The new date is June 14th at 12 noon. So that actually gives us more time than we originally thought.
Well, that makes sense because that corresponds with qualifying.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So with that being said, I'll open the floor up to the six of you to have the conversation or ask the questions that you might want to about the language of both. And I think it might be easier to tackle the one about the reference to the mayor first. I think there was some concern about using the language gender neutral that it may have confused people last time around. So maybe if you can throw out what your thoughts are as to what the phrasing on that item should look like.
What was that phrasing? Instead of using gender neutral,
or just take it out completely.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, just the rewording. Here's the thing, and this is the reality.
Remove all references to he and she.
Most all of the people. Right. No, that's still going to be a problem.
Yeah, right, still going to be a problem. Yeah.
Oh, just say the mayor.
We are in the end times, Sandy. Okay. We are in the end times. So yeah. So, and I'm not being all that funny about it. The reality is I can take the changes will not change. And the reality is that probably 90%+ of the people will never read the changes anyway. So it's a lot that goes into the question. The question has to accurately capture what it does. And I will come up with some language that is appropriately gender neutral so that it won't set people's radar off in a different direction than what's intended. Whether that'll be to reference the mayor as mayor,
In the charter,
something like that. I'll find a way to do it and solve the problem, because I recognize the problem. As I think I told you, this is not the only place this has happened. It's so weird to me that that's where we are, because Ponce Inlet had a charter amendment, the only one that didn't pass. Same thing.
Really?
Same thing. So.
I think you got a good understanding on that one.
I get it,
what we need
and
to
I'll
do.
Fix it.
So the second item, and the one that I think is maybe a bigger discussion for the council, was with regards to the appointment. And I know that there were several council members that thought that appointing someone to fill the vacancy till the next municipal election was too short of a time frame, and there was a concern that if someone had just gotten elected and they had to resign within the first couple of weeks, then
4 months or 2 months or whatever,
it would be closer to 4 years, would be too long.
Right.
So what's council's thoughts on what the language would look like?
Well, what have you seen in other communities?
Okay, well, it's pretty straightforward. It's either one or the other of these things. One, if they've served one day more than half the term, then it's appointed for the remainder of the term, but it also counts towards term limits. If they've served one day less, then it is not. They're not appointed for the remainder of the term. They're appointed for the until the next general election or whenever your next municipal election would be, so you don't have to pay extra for it, and it would not count towards the terms. The only hybrid of that is there are some that say if you can't agree on appointment within X number of days, 30 days, let's say this happened in, I think, Dade City recently, they automatically then go to the next general election, next election, and the state seat stays vacant. So they give themselves a limited time to make the appointment, and if they can't reach an agreement on who to appoint, then it'll automatically go to the election. So some version of those is what you see.
No. I don't think it's an issue of making a decision of who to appoint. It's
You'd be
just,
surprised. When you get down to 3-3,
well,
it
true,
can be.
True, yeah, yeah. And it could have been.
My question is, and after we discussed this, I was thinking about it, and it was, okay, so we just had Corey Nichols vacated seat, but and we were going through the charter review. It's like far-fetched, this whatever happened, but I wouldn't be surprised. What happens if someone, God forbid, passes away, let's say 6 months before their actual election or 4 months before the election, and let's say there was nobody, the person was running unopposed, and it's already past qualifying, that person dies. Now council has to appoint someone.
Right.
But is this person going to be appointed and serve the four-year term?
That's the question.
So
the answer is typically if it was the first part of half of the term, then they would be only appointed until the next election, whenever the municipal election would come around, assuming there's sufficient time. I mean, there are situations where you might be so close up to it, then it'd have to, by nature of the qualifying period, go to the next one. But if it's after half the term, then it's appointed for the remainder of that term, and it doesn't count towards, or depending on where you are and how you want it, it doesn't count towards your term limit. So that's, I mean, and again, you have term limits, other cities don't, so that's an issue for you as to whether you want it to count. Some would say, whatever the appointment is, we don't want it to count for anything regarding term limits, which would make sense, particularly if you were only fulfilling it until the next election, which is the way it's written now. But others would say if they're going to get to serve as many as 2 years of a four-year term, or very close to 2 years of a four-year term, then that should count. That, again, that's a policy call. It's not a preference thing for me or anybody else, really.
So I think maybe just a follow-up question to go off of what Fernando was saying. Supervisor of Election has told us June 14th at 12 noon is the deadline for this November's election.
Mm-hmm.
So the reality is that if you back up from that date, there's an ordinance that needs to be adopted by City Council declaring what's going to be on the ballot and then someone actually resigning. So if someone were to resign too late to actually make this, you're appointing them for the remainder of the term, which is more than 2 years' worth. And in which case, then it would also count as a term served because it's more than 50th percentile.
That's the way it normally would be done, but again, you don't have to do it that way, but that would be typical.
Gotcha. Okay.
Thoughts?
Well, as I said before, I err on the side of giving the voters the opportunity to fill that seat sooner rather than later. That's just where I stand on it. So
that's pretty much where I think you are right now. Because
yes.
It's until whatever.
Right.
Until the next available election.
The only counter is that having to afford to do it multiple times, not everybody can do that. So you're limiting the types of candidates you're going to attract.
So is Form 6.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, but I'm just saying, like, if we want to be inclusive in our ability to attract candidates, which I'm a big fan of inclusivity, then if we do something that puts an undue financial burden on somebody, that may be considered unfair. So that's the counter.
Well, and it's more than just financial. It's the amount of work that goes into running a campaign and having to do two of them back-to-back. That's a heavy ask, I think.
But again, I still say that I feel that the voters making the decision trumps whether, you know, trumps that, really. You know, that's just my feeling.
But I don't think we'd be taking away any vote from them. We'd be adding one, as a matter of fact.
I'm not sure I understand because...
Well, his seat wouldn't come up for that many elections as it stands now. Because he's going to have one in November, then he's going to have one again in 2 years, and then again, and, you know, that wouldn't normally happen in that seat. There's an extra election in there.
Right, but that's because we're giving the voters the opportunity to to fill that vacancy.
Which they would normally have that vote anyways, and not the extra
not
vote.
Not if we change the charter,
right.
They won't have that vote. That's what I'm saying.
Right.
Yeah.
They will have that vote just later.
Oh,
like they always, like they would normally would.
Well, right. It would be whenever Corey's seat was
correct.
Up. But again, I believe that the voters should have that say, not the council. So that's why I support the charter state.
So you would support a special election in that guise,
if that's something we wanted to do, or the charter stay the way it is.
I just think I know we have a really good specific example right now, and this is probably, hopefully, very unique.
Right.
But the fact is, there's potentially 5 people that could be on this November ballot, and that really that concerns me, that potential turnover on our entire council that we're forcing, where we have a good program of staggering our at-large and our council seats, our district seats, you know, so that there's never more than 3 or 4 people that could potentially turn over. So I just think that that's an unintended consequence of this format. And then it gets us off the cycle of having the district seats and the at-large seats on that every 2-year cycle. So I just, yeah, I don't, this is a
It wouldn't change that
one.
Cycle.
Well, it would add, though, so that this person is going, or this seat, in this case, I know this
right.
is one specific case, again, that will hopefully never happen again. No, not this is not personal to you, John.
Well, I'm sure.
But that it will be, you'll have an extra person who's in a district seat that's on the election, on the ballot that.
Well, we would hope it would never happen here again,
yeah.
But I'm sure it happens all across the state all the time.
It happens.
Yeah.
But again, the staggering thing, you're only, even in the general election, you're only fulfilling for whatever was left to Corey's term. So if he had 2 or 3 or whatever he had left, it's not like we're going to start a new 4-year term. So the stagger's
right.
still there.
Right.
It's just that you have 2 campaigns potentially instead of 1 for the same seat for the same term and without it getting any longer. But you also have the potential for a lot of people on the ballot. My biggest fear, and we'll see how it works out, we had 1 resignation, Corey, but there have been 100, more than 100 statewide.
Mm-hmm.
And
some with multiples,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, there's well, 4 out of 5 in one of the commissions.
Yeah.
The issue right now, there's a lawsuit that's been filed. You may be aware of it, where they're challenging it. I don't think it's going to have a great deal of chance of success until or unless the makeup of the legislature changes, which is really the only way you're going to fix that. And again, depending on your view, maybe you don't think it needs fixing. But the bottom line is that, as it sits right now, Form 6 is a big deal, and it's going to affect not only the number of candidates, it has the potential to affect the quality of the candidates you'll get for various reasons. It's funny because people always assume that they're wanting to hide stuff, but a lot of people, what they're wanting to hide is maybe they're not doing as well as the community thinks, or maybe they're doing way better. And either one, they just don't want it to be public knowledge. So, but Form 6 will solve that problem. It will be public knowledge if you want to follow up and read the forms. So I think that of all the concerns that have been expressed here and elsewhere, I'm just concerned about having enough people to run. That's what concerns me.
There's 2 of us that have gone through this now, sitting here. And I'll say from my perspective, and hats off to you for stepping up, but it would have given me pause for sure had I been facing what John's going to be facing without question. I appreciate what Sandy's saying too at the same time that you really want to hear what the voice of the community says and how they feel and let them have the vote. But I would be in favor of modifying it to allow the individual to fulfill the term, whatever the term is, especially in light of Form 6 now and everything, to fulfill the term and then it go to the people.
And I would say the same thing, and maybe, I'm not a big fan of special elections, but maybe if a certain threshold is met time-wise, then we can say, well, then we can go to a special election, that halfway point, or I know they're expensive. Don't want to have to do that, but if that's meeting in the middle, I don't know.
I'll have to flesh that out as to how that might work, because if I understand you correctly, if it was some, if we had just started to turn,
right,
and then somebody quit, or
right,
sick, or died, or moved, which has happened in one of the cities I'm in, then the person would serve for some period of time, but not the full term, but maybe 2 years instead of four, and then we'd have them. I don't know. I need to have more discussion to understand.
Or you have, right, you have a I don't know what that time frame.
Just go directly to a special election.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Within that first year, so to speak, of
or whatever time frame that would be, right. We'd have to make a determination as to how much time would elapse.
That is a possibility. I mean, you could say if the vacancy occurs within the first year of a new term, for whoever it might be, then that would be filled by special election
to fill the remainder of
The term.
Yeah. Right.
You could do that, and then that would stay vacant, though, for that period of time between the vacancy, and that could be, in some situations, you know, a couple, 3 months.
I don't know. I don't like the special election idea.
I'm not a big fan of it either, but I mean, if I'm doing compromises, then to me, there's a compromise.
I think I'd like to see the draft language on fill the remainder of the term.
Okay.
Then let's debate that as council, because we're going to have to vote on it before it goes to the ballot, and then maybe one or two options even as you start to go through it, because I think that that's...
I can present it either... Here's the thing. It's easy. It's not a lot of words to change.
Mm-hmm.
We already know what you have. To change it to the unfulfilled remainder of the term, that's also not difficult. Where it would become, which we haven't considered, is let's suppose the vacancy occurs right at the end of the term. And so now, instead of having years left, you have a month left. Somebody dies, somebody, whatever. Somebody gets arrested. That's never happened at Jack Beach. So that happens, and now you got a month left. You may be past qualifying. What are you doing now?
That's where I was trying to get to. I was trying to get is June 14th qualifying. Let's say I'm running unopposed. Let's say I'm, thank you guys for trusting me again, but let's say life takes over or something bad happens and I or die, whatever. But let's say I resign or whatever before I get sworn in again. Whether there's a month left, 2 months, what is council going? What they have to appoint someone. Or is that person going to run for re-election in the 26th election? Or are they going to fulfill?
Well, I think that brings up, I mean, can we just make it more broad and leave it more to the council's discretion? Because we could come up with a million scenarios.
Right. Well, I can do whatever you like. The voters will still have to support it since it's a charter change.
Right.
My suspicion is, but it's just that, it is very difficult, in my experience, to convince voters to give up the opportunity to vote. Mm-hmm. And so it depends on how it's packaged. If you, I went through this recently in a city in which they have no districts, and they talked about districting, and when I explained that that meant, well, then instead of being able to vote for five offices, you will get to vote for one plus the mayor who's at large. You mean I won't get to vote for those other three? Nope, not interested. Because we're losing an opportunity to vote.
Right.
So it's hard to know how your electorate will react. But
let's have that. And I'm conscious of the time because I know we've got the auditors that need to present to you before the 6 o'clock meeting. Let's have Cliff get some samples of what's being done in other jurisdictions around the state, and we've got some time now with June 14th being out on the horizon, and we'll have the opportunity for y'all to take a look at those and talk about it some more.
What kind of time do we have now, given the change?
June-ish. In reality, you'd need to adopt something in May in order to go on to hit that June 14th deadline. In theory, you could do end of May, beginning of June.
The second meeting in May and the first meeting in June. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So given that we're just in March now, you've got a couple of months that we can work this.
And I guess I would just say we have again, we're looking at this one example, but I would feel differently on day two of someone's term versus day 1,000 of someone's term. So I think that there's no gray area in how we have it now. And I don't know if we can get that in there, but I think it's worth looking at.
We'll see what some others have done. Okay. With that, Cliff and I are going to step back. We're going to turn over the floor to our CFO and the auditors to give you your presentation.
So we have finished our fiscal 2023 audit and have prepared our financial statements. I think I emailed a copy to y'all last week. We have our external auditors, Barbara Boyd and Megan Kant here to walk through the audit and the financial data summary. So with that, I'll turn it over to y'all.
Well, good evening, I guess, everybody. I'm Barbara Boyd. I'm the partner in charge of the audit. Megan Kant is the senior audit manager in charge of the audit. You have either hard copy or PDF, the CRA, and the annual comprehensive financial report. I'm only going to go over this little summary that I've prepared. So obviously, this is just a summary of this. If there are any questions about what's in here, I'm happy to take a look at that. All right, so we'll start with the summary of the auditor's results. And basically, within the bound reports, there are several reports at the beginning of the book and at the end of the book that have our letterhead on it. Anything that has our letterhead on it is something that we wrote. Everything else is management's responsibility. So the summary of auditor's reports, the first is the auditor's opinion on the financial statements and notes. You received an unmodified opinion, which is the highest level of assurance that we as auditors can provide. That report is basically telling you that we gathered sufficient evidence, looked at enough documents that we felt that the financial statements were fairly stated in all material respects. That's an unmodified opinion. We also, the second item on there is the report on internal control over financial reporting and on compliance and other matters. This is what we refer to as the Yellow Book report. It's required by government auditing standards to be included here. As part of any audit, we look at your internal control processes over financial reporting and any compliance issues that we might find that could affect financial reporting. Through that process, if we identify any significant deficiencies or material weaknesses, we report those to you. Or if we identify any significant non-compliance, we again report those to you. So I'm pleased to say there's no reportable items in there. It is a completely clean report. We also have a couple of examination reports. One is with compliance with Florida Statute 218.415, the local government investment policies, and the other is with Florida Statute 163.387, 6 and 7. Those are the redevelopment trust funds, so those are just in the CRA report. So the Auditor General requires us to include an examination report on compliance, which means that we have looked at the city's compliance and the CRA's compliance with those statutes and determine that you are in compliance. So no issues to report there. You did qualify for a single audit this year. You had significant ARPA funding, so you had anytime you have more than $750,000 of either federal or state funding, you're required to undergo a single audit. And in a single audit, we kind of dig into that program, whatever major program that is, and make sure that the city's activities are in compliance with the requirements of that grant. And then we look at internal controls over compliance there as well. So no issues to report there. And then finally, we issue a management letter in accordance with Chapter 10550, Rules of the Auditor General. In that letter, among other things, there's a number of standard language that we're required to put in there. But if there were any prior year findings, we would follow up on them. There were no prior year findings for the city or the CRA. If there are any new findings or recommendations, any internal control issues that didn't rise to the level of a significant deficiency or a material weakness, we included in that management letter. No reportable issues. So absolutely clean reports. It's a great job. The next page is actually, the next couple of pages are a summary of the stapled letters that you received that are separate from the bound reports. And those are communications with those charged with governance, so we spend a little more time going through those letters. And they include information that helps you assess not only the financial statements, but also the results of the audit. So the first page here, the qualitative aspects of accounting practices, these are matters that are in your financial statements that management really has some control over. So your accounting policies, for example, there's a couple of different accounting policies that management can choose as long as they're in accordance with the standards and they're consistent from year to year. That's what we review, and that's what we make sure that they are. And so no significant changes to your accounting policies. There was an implementation of a new accounting standard this year, GASB 96, and it required subscription-based IT arrangements, long-term, what we call SPIDAs, to be recorded in your financial statements as a liability and a right-to-use asset. Management did evaluate all their SPIDAs, but none of them were material enough to be recorded or recorded, so they were not. There were no significant changes because of the new accounting standard in your financial statements. Significant estimates. Again, management has some control over estimates, right? So the inputs that go into calculating what your pension expense might be or your depreciation expense or your allowance for doubtful accounts, those are the significant estimates are listed here. We look at the underlying assumptions for those estimates and make sure that they're reasonable and consistent from year to year, that there's no issues there, that no management bias included in
them. Can I ask just a clarifying question? Because it was in this section with the pension. And I referenced in note 16, I believe, to provide clarification, but the phraseology that was used where there's a, if we were to change our policies, it'd be a significant change. Yeah. Is when you use that phrase, is significant just to mean a percent of change, or is there a dollar value limit that makes it significant, or is it just the discretion of the author?
Yeah, there's a dollar value in what we consider to be material. There is some judgment into what significant might be. It's not quite as technical as material, maybe.
Right.
But really, it has to change the opinion of the user of the financial statement. So something that's big enough that it might affect decision-making by the users.
I'm just kind of curious if
it's
a pass-fail or something.
Yeah, some of them are. Some of them are more gray.
Thank you.
And then on the following page, continuing significant audit matters, I consider this page to be more of the qualitative aspects of the auditing side of things, not the accounting side of things. So if we encountered any issues in dealing with management, if we had material audit adjustments, or any issues that we might have run into during the audit, we report them here. So pleased to say there are no difficulties encountered in dealing with management. They're always very pleasant to work with. In fact, this is the first governmental audit that I get out this year, so that's good on your team, especially since you've been dealing with a lot of things as well, so that's a great job. And then adjustments detected by the audit process. We did have two material audit adjustments that we identified. One was related to the pension expense, and another was related to the tax increment funding that was returned to the taxing authorities. What I will say about these two audit adjustments is they were just in how something was recorded and not anything that was an issue into how anybody was paid or retirement contributions or the taxing refunds to the taxing authority. So it was really just a clerical error in one of the schedules that were used to prepare this and something that had to be corrected for financial statement reporting purposes. And then there were two what we consider to be immaterial audit adjustments, and that those had to do with the liability and the SPIDAs that just were not material or significant enough to require being reported as liabilities and right to use assets. So those were passed on by management. Other than that, there's a couple of new accounting standards that are coming up that we have discussed with management. They shouldn't have too much of a significant effect, but we do once GASB 100 on accounting for changes and error corrections, and the other one, GASB 101, on accounting for the compensated assets as liabilities. So that's something that's on the radar for management. So that's it for reports. that are included in the financial statements. And then I've got a few pages here on financial highlights. So the first on governmental funds, this is your general fund, your capital project funds, ARPA, your CRA. So this is any special revenue funds. Anything that's a governmental fund is included here. You can see your total revenues were up $14.5 million this year. And there's three main drivers of that. The first is your taxes are up $3.7 million, and that's primarily driven by property taxes and an increase in assessed values. Second line item here is the intergovernmental revenues. That went up $5 million, and that's primarily ARPA. So you received the ARPA funds last year, but they were deferred until they're spent. And so as you're spending on those projects, you're seeing that revenue being recognized. And then finally, your investment income last year, as you all know, was not a great economic year. That has changed this year. So last year, you had an unrealized loss of $1.8 million. That's an increase, a gain this year of $3.5 million. So that caused a pretty significant change in your revenues. Your expenditures are up as well, not quite as much as the revenues, but anything from not excluding the capital outlay, so you're from general government down to parks and rec, in total is about a 10% increase, and the primary driver on that is personnel costs, as you had a pay study done last year, so that's going into effect in 23. And you ended the year, your net change in fund balance, there was an increase of $12.6 million that you added to your fund balance. So you can see that to the right there, you have a beginning fund balance of almost $84 million, an increase of 12.6, so your ending total fund balance is $96.5 million. A lot of that is in restricted, about $61 million, and $43 million of that is the CRA. In committed, the $8.5 million of committed includes $7.2 million of revenue stabilization, which you had to use this year. And then your assigned fund balance of $27 million has almost, say, $6.7 million of emergency reserves, and it's got about $20 million of assigned for capital projects. So this is money that you're setting aside for capital projects to pay as you go for any capital improvements. The CRA, since we have a separate CRA report, I've shown separately here, but there's, you know, really the same patterns. Your taxes are up, your investment income is up, and then you can see your ending fund balance on the right side, the right table there, what's restricted for downtown and what's restricted for South End districts. So you've got $33 million almost for downtown and about $11 million for South End. So one of the things that's in the examination report, it's required by statute, is that those funds either be encumbered or spent by a certain time frame. So we do ensure that those funds are encumbered and they are committed to certain projects. So while it's significant, you do have plans to spend that money. And then the enterprise funds, total revenues and total expenses are down, but in this case, our revenues are down significantly more than our expenses. The primary driver for the revenue decrease is the decrease in power costs. So you can see that down in the purchase power, the expenses, that's down $9.7 million, and you can see your electric is down, your electric revenue is down $10 million, and your natural gas revenue is down $600,000. So, and as those power costs are passed through to customers, it affects how much your revenues are. You did have some increases in your water and wastewater and your sanitation revenues. Water and wastewater was pretty much CPI rate increases, a little bit, very small consumption increase. And then your sanitation is phased-in increases to your customers to offset the contract cost increases. On the expense side, you see your personnel services are up about $3.1 million. About half of that is actual salary and benefit increases. That's part of that pay study. The other half is the GASB 68, the pension adjustment, accounting adjustment. So as your net pension liability increases, that pension adjustment increases as well, but it's not cash going out. It's an accounting adjustment. So, you know, as that net pension liability very changes from year to year, it creates some kind of wild swings in that personnel cost expense in your enterprise funds. And then your other operating expenses, part of that is the $1.6 million sanitation cost increases. Part of that is internal charges for utility services and other indirect costs. And then just a number of other cost increases. And finally, just a quick look at the pensions. And really here just to show you the five-year history of how the pensions are doing and what I meant when we saw significant changes in those net pension liabilities, right? So one thing to mention is your pensions are 1 year behind. So the line I have highlighted here is 2022 because you use the liability as of 9/30/22 to report in your 9/30/23 fiscal year 23 financial statements. The accounting standards allow a 1 year lag. And so last year, everything looked really good because the market had done very well, and that decreased your net pension liability significantly. This year, that flipped as was expected, and so you're back to a more historically normal, I would say, net pension liabilities for all three plans. And you see the same trend in all three plans. That's it. I try to talk fast.
Well done.
Putting this together for us, it helps a lot.
It's good reading.
Yeah, but everybody enjoys reading it as much as I do.
It's always good news to hear that we're okay and staff is doing their due diligence.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, you hear from other cities that are doing way worse than us, so we're lucky and appreciate you guys.
I didn't understand that first, but I got clarification from Ashley what allowance for doubtful accounts was, but she explained it to me, so I don't know if you wanted to mention that to the rest of the council members, but
it's the percentage that we look at our accounts receivables at the measurement period, and our estimate we've been using forever is, you know, percent collected at 30 days overdue, 60 days overdue, 90 days overdue. And so that's the kind of calculation you make in book. But I will tell you, with our utilities, our actual write-off expense is extremely low because we have a very effective kind of collections group that's very kind of interactive with our community. So we really are only ever writing off like 0.1% of our total utility revenue. So you would probably stop at that. But we have to kind of choose a formula each year, and so that's kind of what they're talking to. And there's the calculation that we're doing and making sure we're doing the same thing as the year over year.
You learn something new every day.
Have we started receiving the opioid settlement money, and where will that be housed?
So we've received about $250,000 of the opioid settlement money to date. And that is shown in the restricted fund balance from the general fund because council is still kind of making determination of how you guys want to deploy those funds. So it will stay restricted until we start investing in whatever program.
Great. And thank you to you and your team for not being difficult.
Yeah.
It was great. The cookies help.
Yeah.
I know the cookies help.
To move back to your point, Barbara had mentioned that for the estimates and the allowance for doubtful accounts is one of those. One of the things that we always look for is potential management bias. In general, as Ashley stated, the write-off percentage is relatively low. What we've noticed is generally management's estimates are going to be very conservative, and we have seen the value of that, particularly this year, with that revenue stabilization assignment of the fund balance and, you know, just the back, hold back for those potential emergencies, or if revenue needs to be stabilized for one reason or another, the billing system not being able to work correctly. That is just another indication of the conservatism of your finance staff maintaining this consistency within your operational structure. Something we very much like to see.
Yeah. Likewise.
Thank you.
Do you have Warren still on?
I think he's still gone.
3 weeks, right?
That sounds right.
I wish my honeymoon would be that long.
I feel like they're wrapping it up. Bill and his anniversary.
Is he getting back?
Possibly. I forget what date.
He sent us. Yeah, I can't
remember. I didn't spend a lot of time.
So this concludes our special briefing for March 4th. We will have another regular briefing next week at 5:30 on March 11th. This is not in lieu of that briefing. We'll have a handful of topics to go over when you have that time. And 6 o'clock is our regular meeting.